This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Protests against the rule of Ayatollah Khomeini are filling the streets of Iran. U.S. President Donald Trump has been a lot more publicly supportive of the protesters than Barack Obama was during the 2009 Green Revolution. But how deep does American support go, and how much of a threat does these protests pose to the Iranian regime? We're going to talk with Trumpet writer Callum Wood about this story. The Japanese military was famously brutal during World War II, and it led to the creation of the nation's pacifist constitution once that war was lost. In recent years, Japan has moved away from this position. It's returning to a stronger, more nationalistic, even militaristic posture. We'll talk with Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about why this is a significant trend to keep our eyes on. If you've listened to Trumpet Radio lately, you may have heard us mention an archaeological dig starting this month in Jerusalem. Our man on the ground in that city, Brent Noctegal, he's going to be involved, along with a dozen of our staff and Herbert W. Armstrong College students. We're going to talk to Brent. We're going to get the story straight from him about what they'll be up to and the preparations that are underway for our crew there as they swell from five times its present size. So that'll be very exciting to talk with him. We're also going to talk with David Vigil, our online marketing manager, to get an update on our website, thetrumpet.com, looking back at 2017 and a few trends there. And finally, a few words to you husbands about what to do when your wife is discouraged. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Iran is in a bit of turmoil right now. Protests against the government have grown to tens of thousands of people across the country. The government of Ayatollah Khomeini has vowed to crack down hard against these protests. What might happen here? We need to look at this in the big picture of Bible prophecy. And the Trumpet has written a lot about Iran's role in prophecy over the years. To talk about this, we have from our office in Australia, Trumpet writer Callum Wood. Hello, Callum.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on the show.
Yeah, it's good to be talking to you again. It's been a while. So this is a really interesting development. Apparently, when the nuclear deal with Iran was struck, this was to be the end of sanctions against Iran. This was going to provide economic relief for Iranians. Certainly, that was the expectation. But it hasn't panned out because that money has been used to fund weapons development, terrorist activities, and so on. So the people who were expecting this economic improvement are upset. What do you make of what's happening there right now?
Yes, well, in response to those protests, U.S. President Donald Trump said that the Iranian people are crying out for food and freedom. Food and freedom. And these are some of the things that Rouhani himself, President Rouhani of Iran, campaigned upon. He promised people that there would be economic relief, that middle-class Iranians would prosper under his rulership. And especially, as you mentioned, when the nuclear deal came through, there was this huge cash windfall came to Iran, and everybody was expecting that that money, well, certainly everyone in the West, and I'm sure a lot of Iranians were hoping that that money would then trickle down to the populace. But as we've seen, that hasn't happened. Instead, we've seen the Iranian military, particularly the IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard, we've seen them have this enormous bonus, you might say, more money to spend on the military, more money to spend on their Quds force, their international force, and obviously, which is a terrorist organization. We've seen the money all directed towards a lot of Iran's regional goals as far as regional hegemony, controlling the Middle East, particularly propping up Bashar al-Assad in Syria and elsewhere. We've seen the finances go towards that and not towards the everyday Iranian citizens. And that has upset a lot of people, particularly the younger people in the country who are a bit more connected as far as the internet, social media goes. We've seen them start to rally together. And while these protests have been somewhat spontaneous, there's certainly, it's highlighted a big movement there is in Iran to try and bring about some changes.
So it's interesting to consider this in light of the bigger picture of what we've talked about for quite a long time at the Trumpet, you know, in terms of Iran's future. But in 2009, this is really the biggest show of public discontent that we've seen in Iran since the Green Movement in 2009. And at that time, as we've drawn attention to quite a lot, the Obama administration was far more supportive of the ruling Iranian regime and the mullahs of Iran than it was the protesters who were trying to draw attention to how unjust that regime was. The Obama administration, as we now know, was in the middle of trying to strike a deal with Iran, and they were in back channel conversations with the Iranian regime. So it was clear which side of the issue the Obama administration came down. A lot of people have criticized him for failing to nurture this democratic uprising within Iran. It seems that the Trump administration, certainly Donald Trump's Twitter account, he's been much more openly supportive of the protesters. The question is, what substantively would the United States do differently? How much would they actually offer in the way of support to this movement? And does this movement really pose a threat to the Iranian regime?
Absolutely. I think that's the question everybody is pondering, is what is America's response going to be? A lot of the more conservative commentators in America are calling on Donald Trump to take action. Some are calling for military action. Some are calling for more strong political action. At the moment, all we've really seen is some pretty strong tweets coming out of the White House. And while it is great to see the president lending some support to the Iranian people, we do have to question just how much support there's going to be. I think that there is an element of risk involved as well, considering it's still quite early on in the protests. When you look back to the Green Movement that you mentioned before in 2009, there was some 150 cities, or 170 cities, some people claim, that were up in arms. You had hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people on the streets. And yet this time around, it's still quite early on. The movement's very spontaneous. It doesn't seem to have a leader at the moment. So it is somewhat disorganized. Yes, there have been quite a few people out on the streets. We've seen rallies of some 300,000 people, but it has been confined to, at the moment, just a few cities. So you could see the president and his staff maybe waiting a little bit longer to see if this thing starts to take some traction. But at that point, what sort of action could we expect? And I think we could expect not a whole lot at this point in time. And I say that only because we can look back at what Iran has done in the last year during Donald Trump's time in office. And if we could say, if Donald Trump wasn't willing to react to some of the things that Iran has done this year, how likely is it really going to be that Donald Trump and the White House will react to a few hundred thousand people protesting in Iran? For that, we could look back to Syria. We can look at what's happening in Iraq with the Shia militias that are there now, that are really filling in a role that America should have had in the first place. We see Iran basically being the security force of Iraq at the moment. They are the ones that held the Islamic State in check. And now that the Islamic State's driven out, we see these Shia militias and the like, that all controlling Iraq and, of course, the border with Syria as well. We see them propping up Bashar al-Assad, this terrible murderer of his people. And America seems very lax to get involved there. And so if we see Iran propping up somebody who uses chemical weapons on his own people, how likely do we think it'll be that he's going to take action, take action against Iran when we see a few protests with a few people killed here and there?
That's a good point. I can't help but think back to when the first Gulf War took place and the Kurds in Iraq had risen up, they were looking to the United States for support, and the United States said, "Yeah, you know, we support you, we've got your back." And then when it came down to it, the United States did not support them, and they were squashed by the Saddam Hussein regime at that time. And it really was a pretty massive betrayal of the Kurds by the United States. And at that time, Gerald Fleury at the Trumpet. He was writing about this and said that the United States is going to live to regret what the way that they treated the Kurds there. You look at the Trump administration, you could certainly see how he would be excited to demonstrate the optics of handling the situation very differently than Barack Obama did, what, 8 years ago. But it is hard to see how the United States would actually commit to doing things that would be substantially different, substantively different than what America did at that time, in a way that would guarantee a different outcome. It does seem like I'd like to just transition to talk about the way that we've been talking about Iran all this time, because you can't help but think about this as you're seeing these protests take place based on the prophecies that we talk about at the Trumpet. Maybe you could just talk us through how you're looking at this from the standpoint of what Gerald Fleury has been saying about Iran and our expectations based on prophecy.
Absolutely. Anyone who has been watching the Trumpet, listening to these radio programs for any length of time, knows that we pinpoint Iran as the head of what is, the Bible terms, as the King of the South, which is an Islamic bloc of nations, a radical Islamic bloc of nations. It's going to be led by Iran. It's talked about in Daniel 11. And we know that some of the nations that are going to be involved in this alliance, that we have Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, some of these nations, which at the moment looks like it couldn't happen, or a lot of people scoff at the idea of it happening. Yet when you look back at history, you can see how Iran has just grown into that role, particularly since 1979 and the Iranian Revolution. Mm-hmm. And we look back at that time and we see the Shah of Iran was overthrown. These radical clerics came into power, and Iran went from a small-scale Persian nation, and particularly in the last 20 years, they have just risen to be the regional power. They, as I mentioned earlier, they have a lot of control across Iraq, Syria, southern Lebanon. When the Muslim Brotherhood was in power in Egypt, we saw just how quickly Iran could capitalize on a situation, take control, and build its influence. And that's exactly what we're seeing at this time. We're seeing Iran continue its rise as in this role as the King of the South. Daniel 11:40 talks a lot about its role and its place in Bible prophecy. And so when we look at Iran today and we see these protesters rising up and they're calling for the ousting of Ayatollah Khomeini, it's very hard to see that happening and see Iran return, let's say, to a more a moderate approach, a more moderate nation, because mm-hmm. the trend has just been one that's just gotten steeper and steeper, the curve of just radicalism. We've seen Iran more engaged in Iraq today than it ever has been before. We see it sponsoring terrorism like never before. They're closer to having the nuclear weapon now than ever before. And more we're seeing Iran just grow into this role as King of the South. And as far back as the early 90s, July 1992, Mr. Fleury, he wrote an article entitled "An Islamic King of the South," wherein he wrote, "The King of the South could rule Iraq or Iran or both countries, but it is looking more now like Iran may produce this king." And ever since that time, back there in 1992, Iran has proved that statement true time and time again. And even in 2009, when you had more than 150 cities that were in Iran that were protesting and calling for the ousting of Ayatollah Khomeini and Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, all these protests were going on, and so many people in the world were saying, this could be it, this could be the moment that Iran turns back to a more moderate approach like it had under the Shah of Iran. But we were saying, no, that's not the case. Look at prophecy and look at the trends that are going on through Iran now. And sure enough, the clerical bodies in Iran, they cracked down hard on the protesters. They jailed a lot of opposition, some of whom are still under house arrest today. There was heavy-handed police tactics, of course, as we're seeing again today. And ultimately, Ahmadinejad, whom people were protesting against because he had come back into office for a second term when most people clearly didn't want him, he was back in power and had the full support of the Ayatollah and the clerical regime. And so we're saying the same thing again now. We look at these protests and they are smaller at the moment than the Green Movement, but we look at the support quote unquote, that's coming from the White House and elsewhere, and it just doesn't exist. At the moment, we're dealing with a different Iran than even in 2009. They're much more well-equipped, better financed. They have a lot more leverage. If America was to try and get involved, Iran has a much tighter stranglehold on critical sea gates and the Persian Gulf. They have a lot of influence in Iraq and elsewhere that could make, particularly Syria as well.
More international support as well as a result of the nuclear deal.
Absolutely. You can imagine how unpopular Donald Trump would be. Let's say if he took the military route. I mean, half of his own nation would probably be against that, you would think, the more left-leaning populace of America. But then the international community, the other P5 plus one nations that worked so hard on this nuclear deal with Iran, well, you can't imagine that deal existing if the US took a military approach. Those other nations then would be even more opposed to U.S. influence in the Middle East at that point than they are already.
Yeah, I think about the prophecy in Daniel 11, verse 40 that you referred to earlier, where it talks about a king of the South pushing at the king of the North. And Gerald Fleury has talked about just how this indicates a very provocative foreign policy on the part of this king, that it is one that is leading the world toward war. And all of those things that you mentioned, the support of international terrorism, the pursuit of nuclear weapons, the way that Iran has conducted itself is provocative. It is pushy, exactly the way that prophecy describes. You wouldn't expect that if there were to be some kind of a sea change politically within Iran that took it in a different direction. But you go back and you look at those statements that Gerald Fleury made, you know, way, way back, based on this understanding of this prophecy and pointing to Iraq. You mentioned just how some of the allies within those prophecies, when you look at the situation as it is right now, we don't see those alliances manifested. You could say the same thing, though, about Iraq at the time that he was talking about that. Iraq was the number one enemy of Iran, and yet what happened was that now we have a situation where Iraq is extremely closely allied with Iran, exactly the way that Gerald Fleury said, based on those prophecies. So we do have we have this track record, basically, of allowing the prophecy to govern our understanding of the way that the region works, even when maybe some of the facts on the ground would suggest an opposing analysis. And events unfold in a way that vindicates that approach. So when you're looking at a situation like this, you can definitely take that reliability of the prophetic view to the bank in terms of being able to predict how things are going to unfold in the time ahead. Very interesting to watch what's going on here. I'm sure there's still going to be a couple of twists and turns that we're not yet anticipating, but we definitely can look at the outcome based on these prophecies. If you were to point anyone to relevant material that would help them to get this in better context, what would you point people to, Callum?
Well, certainly the Trumpet website is just chocked full of information on Iran. For those who want more of a read, we certainly have books and booklets that cover a lot of this information. The King of the South by Mr. Fleury, which he originally penned back in the early 90s, is more relevant today. We have added to it. There's more relevance today than ever before. So I would highly encourage people who are more interested in an in-depth read to go and take a look at that book. If not, we are working on trend articles for the Trumpet, where we have articles coming up all the time about events. Certainly, I'm sure there'll be some on the protests and other twists and turns that you mentioned across the Middle East that involve Iran. But these trend articles that we're working on, they really do go into quite a lot of detail about we'll have trends on all sorts of prophetic events, but we do have trends on Iran and its rise, and they're chocked full of facts that back up statements that we've made for decades, and statements that God made and had recorded in his Bible thousands of years ago.
Excellent. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Callum Wood. He's actually working on one of those trends articles. This is why the Trumpet watches Iran leading the rise of Islamic terrorism. So collating some of these past statements that we've made in the Trumpets from years ago, Gerald Fleury has started back in the early 1990s and showing how these stack up against what we've seen actually unfold in that country in the time since then. You can watch for that. It'll appear on the website here within the next few weeks at least. But Colin, we certainly appreciate your time. Fascinating subject to look into. Thanks for your insights.
Always appreciate coming on the show.
The voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
In World War II, Japan earned a reputation as an absolutely brutal military power. But once the war ended, when two of its cities were decimated by nuclear bombs, the United States implemented a pacifist constitution, and ever since, Japan has been largely governed by leaders who have complied with this approach. Recently, however, under Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, we've seen a strong anti-pacifist movement taking place in Japan. This has huge implications for the future of Asia, and it's an important trend that we in the Trumpet watch for its importance in biblical prophecy. To talk about this, we have from our offices in Britain, Trumpet writer Kieran Underwood. Hello, Kieran.
Hello, thanks for having me.
Oh, it's good to talk with you. We don't have you on here too often, but you've written a really quite powerful article here on thetrumpet.com. I wanted, if you wouldn't mind, just start by giving us a brief history lesson or just a reminder of how Japan earned this reputation in World War II. Why America was so strong about stripping Japan of its militaristic capabilities.
Well, I think we can start with two things. One of them would be the Nanking Massacre, when this was a period of Japan's history when they went into China. They took over a certain part of that country, and there was these huge massacres where thousands and thousands of people were killed. There's these stories of soldiers throwing up babies and then catching them on the end of their bayonets. Just horrific stories like that. That's one part of it, one part of the history. And then the second part is obviously World War II. Right at the end of World War II, we see it had to be ended with a nuclear bomb, Hiroshima and Nagasaki, two nuclear weapons. And the reason that the Americans believed that had to happen was because they didn't think Japan would ever give up the fight. They had been bombing a lot of cities in Japan, and the way the Japanese people were at the time and the way they reverenced their leader as nearly a god, they just were not going to give up the fight. They had wasted hundreds of thousands of lives, and the Americans believed that this was the only way. The Japanese were so militaristic in their thinking at that time that it had to be ended with an atom bomb. So after World War II, the Americans believed that that was their spirit and that their spirit of militarism had to be changed through what General MacArthur wanted, a pacifist constitution.
So what we've been seeing more recently, and particularly under Prime Minister Abe, is resurrecting maybe some of the concerns of that that World War II history. It seems like those who suffered from Japan's aggression at that time, and those who best remember it, are looking at what's happening right now, and they're expressing some concern. Let's just talk about some of the things that Japan is doing that is maybe causing that concern. First of all, one of the big changes that we're seeing right now is that the Japanese actually seem to be warming up to the idea of becoming a nuclear power. Tell us about that.
Okay, well, I'll introduce this with a quote from a historian of Japan. His name is Kenneth Pyle, and he described in 2012, when he was asked about the eight no's of Japan's post-1945 security policy, what they would do after 1945.
This is under that pacifist constitution that you're talking about that MacArthur implemented.
Exactly right. So the eight no's were no overseas deployments, no exercise of collective self-defense, no power projection capability, no nuclear arms, no arms exports, and no sharing defense technology, no military spending above 1%, and no military use of space. And he said in 2015 that all those eight no's are gone except for the nuclear option. And now we're seeing that that nuclear option is being put on the table. Now, it's not being put on the table by every politician, and it's not even being accepted. But it was a taboo subject that you would not even mention in years previous. And now there's a few people who are coming out and saying, well, we really have to discuss this considering North Korea and a lot of the other threats which are around.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, one of the people who's bringing it up is President Donald Trump.
Yeah, like a lot of things, he seems to be the one who said something that no one else wanted to say, and then afterwards, people come out backing him up a little bit. Even Henry Kissinger, who was a former U.S. Secretary of State, and essentially the foreign policy expert of the 20th century in some people's eyes,
saying it wouldn't be such a bad idea for Japan to be a nuclear power.
Well, he said nuclear weapons must spread in the rest of Asia, considering North Korea.
Yeah. Yeah, that's quite phenomenal. So then maybe what's coming from the politicians within Japan, and are there any steps that are actually being taken to realize this? On top of that, how capable would Japan be of entering or becoming a nuclear power based on the technology it has at hand?
Well, there's one former defense minister. His name is Shigeru Ishiba. In September, he said that Japan should debate abolishing its three non-nuclear principles. Those three non-nuclear principles are of not possessing and not producing and not hosting nukes on the Japanese soil. So he said, we need to debate that. And then the diplomat wrote that Shinzo Abe's government had already responded to these questions earlier by saying that Article 9, which is the article in the Constitution, the pacifist article in the Constitution, does not really prohibit nuclear weapons from being on Japanese soil.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, moving on, I guess another aspect of what Japan is changing is its approach to missile defense. Tell us about that.
Well, with missile defense, they've typically had two structures, and one of those structures is a land-based system, and the other structure is this Navy-based system where they'll defend themselves from any missiles, say North Korea shoots a missile at them or China shoots a missile at them. And these two have really not been capable of covering the whole country. And they've now just decided in the last few months that they need to buy a system that will just cover the whole country. And they bought it from America. They bought it from the United States. It's called Aegis Ashore, and it's about, I think, around $1.8 billion that they spent on this. But they just realized we cannot afford to have systems that may only cover parts of the country or may not even work if we don't have our ships in the right place. They realized we need the whole country covered, and we just need to spend the money on it.
So they did it.
$1.8 billion.
So missile defense, this is, I guess, all of this that you're talking about, this is essentially Japan ostensibly responding to the threats that are happening within the region. It seems like missile defense is definitely one that they could point to and say, well, look at what North Korea is doing. And as concerned as the United States might be about belligerency on the North Korean peninsula, we are even under greater threat because we're in such close proximity to this nation. So all of these things that they're pursuing, they do ostensibly have a sense of legitimacy about them. And say the way that Donald Trump would talk about it, the way that Henry Kissinger or others looking at the situation, that what choice does Japan have but to pursue these kinds of technologies?
That's exactly right. And I can see why a lot of Japanese people are thinking, we need these systems, we need these defensive capabilities, and we even need offensive capabilities. Otherwise, we're just a sitting duck waiting for things to happen. That's a lot of the fear that the everyday person on the street of Japan who's had alarms going off as North Korea sending missiles over their country and landing hundreds of miles off their coast, they're thinking, we really cannot rely on America all the time, because what if they fail us in the future?
Yeah. And how much is Japan putting its money behind these initiatives? Just talk about the military spending.
Well, this year, Japan will be seeing a 1.3% increase in their military spending. But the big figure is $46 billion, and this is the figure of their total defense spending right now, $46 billion, or it will be in 2008. And that is, I think that's around the seventh or eighth ranked in the world. So you have a country which is essentially calls itself pacifist. They spend $46 billion on their defense. A lot of people think, rightly so, they're in a very dangerous region, but it's ranked seventh or eighth in the world, even though they're self-proclaimed pacifists.
Yeah, that's phenomenal. Well, you put it in the context of everything that's happening in Asia more broadly, and particularly with Russia and China and the military spending and the increases that they're seeking after in the pursuit of more aggressive foreign policy and the technology to back that policy. And it is quite extraordinary. There's quite an arms race going on over in Asia. Looking at this from the standpoint of biblical prophecy, where does Japan fit into this, and what direction do we expect this to go? Why is this such an important trend for us to be watching?
Well, I'll read you a quote from Herbert W. Armstrong, who wrote about this in 1971. He said, "Japan today has no military establishment." And when he wrote that in 1971, he was right. But he said, "But we should not lose sight of the fact that Japan has become so powerful economically that it could build a military force of very great power very rapidly."
Mm-hmm.
And I think you can see that already. You see a country which is the third largest economically in the world and has seventh or eighth now in their defense spending, and they with a click of a finger they could rise up that list very, very fast. They could become fifth, fourth, third, second largest spender very quickly. They have the capability to do so. And we look at this really in terms of what we talk about the kings of the East. So in Bible prophecy, the kings of the East are these set of kings or dictators that are to the east of Jerusalem, and they combine their might and their armies, and we expect that Japan will be part of these kings of the East. Normally we talk about, on the trumpet, we'll talk about kings of the East as Russia and China, those two main ones. But to have the might and the economic ability and even just the numbers, you really would need to see Japan within that king of the East group.
Yeah. And Herbert Armstrong talked about that specifically. And there are specific prophecies that refer to Japan lending its military might to this. You can look at it logically speaking, that somehow or other China and Japan are going to have to overcome their differences. You see a certain amount of that taking place, a certain amount of rapprochement between those two countries. But looked at prophetically, it explicitly talks about Japan being a part of this alliance. We actually have a booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that has an entire chapter about Japan, what it's going to add to that Eastern alliance. Is there anything else that you would point people to that would provide greater context to what you're talking about?
Well, I think I can point people to something a little smaller than the Russia and China book, which we have, which is the comprehensive one. But I would point the reader to an article that Jeremiah Jacques has on the website. It's a trend article called "Why the Trumpet Watches Japan's March Towards Militarism," which goes through and looks a lot of the history of Japan and then how it's been moving forward towards that goal.
Yeah. Well, that's excellent. We've been talking with trumpet writer Kieran Underwood about Japan's militarization. And he's written an article how Japan's hiyawaboke, peace idiots, hiyawaboke, I guess this is a term referring to those who are kind of maybe the politicians and the diplomats who are peace at any price, the ones who were maybe in the spirit of that pacifist constitution from World War II, how yes. these people are losing. The argument within Japan is definitely shifting away from the thinking that has dominated the country for so many decades now. But you can find this article on thetrumpet.com, an excellent read, and it also points you to that trends article from Jeremiah and other resources that will give you more context about why this is such an important trend for us to be watching. Kieran, we sure appreciate your time. It's good to talk to you.
Thanks very much.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
Here on Trumpet Hour, we often talk with our correspondent in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall, about events in the Middle East. Today, we're going to talk about one of those events a bit outside our usual subject matter. That is an archaeology project that he's going to be participating in starting in just a couple of weeks. We're going to be sending a few of our editorial staff over there, along with several students from Herbert W. Armstrong College, to join him. So we're quite excited about this, and to talk about what's going on here, we have Brent on Skype. Hello, Brent.
Hello.
So could you just give our listeners a brief rundown of our past archaeological activities there and the things that we've discovered?
Yeah, we'll have to keep it brief, but our archaeological work in Jerusalem goes back decades. We often quote Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong on the Trumpet Hour. We mention him a lot in our writings on thetrumpet.com. And he was the one that he's basically the reason we're in Jerusalem, is because he had an excavation. He's co-sponsored a massive excavation in the 60s and 70s, just after Israel won East Jerusalem, that opened up a whole area for excavation around the Temple Mount. And Mr. Armstrong, along with Hebrew University, they partnered in a 10-year excavation there, really in the same area that we're going back to dig in a week and a half. They excavated this area for 10 years, and then Mr. Armstrong, with his ambassador college, they sent over students by the dozens every single summer. They excavated just south of the Temple Mount and even in the city of David as well, which is a little bit further south, the more ancient part of the city. And then our work came along and really revived that history, both with archaeology in Jerusalem in this area, but also with the archaeologist that Mr. Armstrong used. He worked with Dr. Benjamin Mazar, former head of Hebrew University in Jerusalem. Dr. Benjamin Mazar, Professor Benjamin Mazar, had a granddaughter, Eilat Mazar, who's now a doctor, accomplished archaeologist in her own right. And we have been working alongside her for 10 years, going back till the October 2006 is when we first sent students from Herbert W. Armstrong College over there to participate. And that was in the Palace of David excavation. She unearthed part of the palace in 2005. We heard about it and asked if we could jump on board with her. And she was just super excited to renew this partnership between Mr. Armstrong, basically, and her grandfather, and she could continue that legacy with us. So we excavated with her in 2006 through 2008 at the Palace of David. During that time, we found a couple of seals, one really important seal that was mentioned in the book of Jeremiah. His name is Gedaliah ben Pashur. He's one of those men that was going to the last king of Israel, Zedekiah, saying, put Jeremiah to death. He's upsetting our people. He's really destroying the morale. We want to fight. He's saying, give in. And he's mentioned by name. Four of these men are mentioned by name. And we found two of them in those excavations at the Palace of David. And then from the palace, we've actually moved about 200 meters north or 250 yards north to the Ophel area, still below the southern wall of the Temple Mount where the Dome of the Rock is. This area is known as the Ophel, just north of the ancient city of David. And here we are excavating what we believe, what Dr. Mazzotta believes, to be a massive structure dating from King Solomon's time. Mm-hmm. And this is this really important period in archaeology in Israel where you have a lot of controversy. A lot of archaeologists say there was no massive building by David and Solomon. And Dr. Mazzotta is digging in Jerusalem with us, and we are excavating massive structures from the time of King Solomon.
So this is really several finds that you've made that verify the biblical account and that have at least put the critics of the Bible to on notice anyway. They have their what they believe are explanations for this, but it just seems like time after time after time, what you're finding is underlining and verifying what we read in the Bible. Now, this area that you said that you're going back to the Ophel now, maybe you could just give us an idea of what she's hoping to accomplish in this dig and what's the scope of it. Just give us some of the details of what you're up to now.
So archaeology, it's a painstaking work and takes a lot of time to go through the different layers that you'll discover. A lot of sites in Europe, a lot of sites or the occasional site in the Middle East, they only have one period, meaning you put your spade in the ground and you're going to find one structure from one time. Mm. Here in Jerusalem and elsewhere in the land, the Promised Land here in Israel, you have up to 20 of these different cities that are built one on top of another for 3,000 years.
That's amazing.
And so to go from the surface level and dig through the dirt, discovering different buildings you have to really delineate which buildings from which period. Mm-hmm. And this is a very painstaking process and takes a bit of time. In the area of the Ophel, a lot of that earlier work was actually done for us during the time of Mr. Armstrong. He worked there, as I said, for 10 years with the Ambassador College, with Hebrew University and Benjamin Mazar. And they took off a lot of those layers from about the last 1,500 years. And so we basically start our excavation in the Byzantine period when the Christians were over Jerusalem. And we will remove those layers and then find the Herodian period, the time of Jesus Christ, and then remove those layers and find the end of the biblical or Old Testament period, the time of Jeremiah, structures from those periods.
Well, so yeah, most and of you, the, you even you uncovered the wall of Nehemiah. This would be the second temple construction period. So you have even going back, I guess, several eras even within the Old Testament period.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And even, yeah, you've got Nehemiah's Zerubbabel's period, and then into the main bulk of the kings of Judah. And we have all those periods represented here on the Ophel. Most of the area we've excavated back in 2012 and 13, and we excavated down to bedrock. And on bedrock, we find Iron 2A or period of Solomon, basically structures built on bedrock, just huge stones entrenched into like carved trenches in bedrock to make sure they don't go anywhere. Massive walls. Nothing underneath those, yeah. Which is significant in itself because, you know, there likely was some type of structures there before in this area through the Jebusite period. That's possible. But what we find mainly is Solomonic era structures. Mm-hmm. But this phase specifically, we are basically continuing on from some leftover unfinished business from back in 2013. Dr. Mazar's been trying to get a license to dig for such a long time, for a couple of years, and that license finally came through to excavate back in October. And so we are going back to the area that we were in 2013, excavating a cistern cave type structure that was filled in during the time of the Second Temple's destruction, during the time that the Romans were there besieging under Titus and taking Jerusalem down. That filled the cistern, this cave cistern. We're unsure. It was a cistern, but it might have functioned as something else before. Mm. And so we're going to excavate that whole cave structure. And then there's also back in 2013, there was an area at the top of our excavation of the Ophel where the golden menorah was found. This was a medallion from the Byzantine period that had a menorah on it, obviously. It had a Torah, it had a shofar, just talking, showing the Jewish connection to this city 1,500 years ago. Well, the rest of that structure, Byzantine structure, wasn't excavated at the time. And so we're going to go back and start from in this Byzantine structure that where we found the golden menorah medallion and then continue through the layers that come underneath that.
How phenomenal to be having your hands on this history, that it's being unearthed before your eyes. It just seems like history is put so little value on in society today. And even the Jews and the way that the way that people tend to talk about the Jewish presence in the Middle East, they're talking about it like this is some recent thing. There's just a lot of people who kind of posit that the Jews, the only reason that they're there is because we put them there here in the last 100 years. But these artifacts prove this presence that has been there for so long. What is it like for you to sort of be digging into history the way that you are, just on a personal level?
I mean, it's very special. It's one thing to live here in Jerusalem and to hear what is said about Israel and the Jewish history here, or the biblical history here, how it's maligned and discredited, and you kind of, somebody has his opinion about history and some other guy has his opinion about history and they're both equal. Nobody really knows what mm-hmm. happened 1,500 years ago. That's ridiculous. That's ridiculous. You can come and dig down through the layers. Yes, you are going to find the Muslim periods. You are going to find the Arab periods, but they're on the surface. They're closer to the top. But dig down and you've got a century and a half of Hebrew writing coming out of the ground. If you're talking about that, the menorah medallion, that's the 6th century AD. They're very Jewish symbols. You mm-hmm. go back 1,500 years before that, and we've found on the Ophel ancient Hebrew inscriptions from 1,000 BC. They're using the same language. The Jews were there for 1,500 years through that period, and obviously they continued thereafter. Personally, though, obviously that Jewish history is very important in itself, but the connection to the biblical history is where it is really important for me. Mm-hmm. We obviously believe in the veracity of the Bible, and to be digging in a location that the Bible centers around, Jerusalem is the center of the scriptures. It will be the center of everything going forward. And so to be digging in the dirt and walking around in structures King Solomon walked in, or King David, or, you know, there with David's men and Solomon's men in this area trying to plan how to build this structure. That's what was happening 3,000 years before I got there. Mm-hmm. And to read in the Bible that, and then to walk in the same area is very powerful.
That is very awesome. So just briefly, can you give us a sense of what kind of preparations you're making now? You said it starts in a week and a half. We're going to be sending a dozen people your way. You've got some scrambling to do here.
Yeah, basically, we'll be heading to the dig site, not this week, but next week, to do some preliminary work. Dr. Mazar was there at the dig site a couple of times today, getting some background information and also alerting different authorities in Israel that need to know what's going on. We'll be heading over there next week. Christopher Eames and I will be working in this cave area. He's another one of our writers, but also an archaeologist, and scoping out how we're going to excavate it before the onslaught of the students arrive. Mm-hmm. And in the meantime, we're just trying to find somewhere to house all these people and figure out ways to keep them fed.
Well, it's marvelous. We hope that we can stay in touch with you and keep up to date with your activities over there. We're very excited. We've been talking with trumpet writer and archaeologist Brent Narktigal about a dig in Jerusalem. We're about to begin. Keep your eye on thetrumpet.com and also the Trumpet's sister website, watchjerusalem.co.il. We're going to be updating that website with what they find over there, and just news about the activities that we're engaged in over there. Brent, thank you so much.
No problem. It's a pleasure.
This is Trumpet Hour.
Another calendar year under our belt, and I thought this would be a good time for us to catch up with David V. Hill, our online marketing manager, to get an update on our website, thetrumpet.com, how things are going there. He's in the studio here with us. Hello, David.
Hello.
It's been a while.
It's nice to be back.
So give us the overview. How are we doing on thetrumpet.com?
Sure. Well, we had about two major overhauls this year on the website, one in March and one in October. The one in March was really big for us as it brought in our mobile audience back to thetrumpet.com. So m.thetrumpet.com went away. We deprecated our app as well, our mobile app on that. And the extra traffic just really helped us out there. And then the October redesign was more just the homepage, but we had a lot of positive feedback on that. And so we are up 68% on users this year from 2016, and our page views went up 18% this year as well. So very big gains for us from those two changes. Pretty interesting to see, too, with the October change, what people are motivated to click on from the homepage. A lot of people like big pictures. So big radio pictures, the big trumpet magazine pictures have really helped bring some more awareness to those items. And, of course, Mr. Gerald Fleury, always a big draw for our website there.
So mobile, more and more people are using mobile and accessing news sites from mobile devices. So what's the trend industry-wide where people are using their phones?
So it's continuing to grow. More people, like as you mentioned, for our website, it's about two-thirds of our audience now is mobile, and that's growing faster and faster. And we can actually see this in how the audience consumes literature. So we've had a big increase in the downloads of our literature this year, came out at 53% increase, but then ordering a physical copy and having it mailed to your house, that went down about 35%. So the trend is for people to have the phone with them to read it right then and there. They can read our literature just with one tap. They can consume it right away. We had a big increase on people reading our literature online. So not through downloads, but actually going into the book chapter by chapter and reading. And that was over double, huge growth there. So that's been really helpful for us, bringing that mobile audience, making everything more mobile friendly, has definitely helped encourage people to read more.
Yeah, I don't get that myself. I would much rather have a book in my hand. We got to make sure that the ones who like to read books can get the books. But one big change, too, that we've made is the trumpet brief. That just started this year. Was that that was last spring? Is that right?
Yes. So we had a
daily email blast.
Yes. Change in our email service there. Daily email blast. The trumpet brief has been a really great success for us this year as well. We've had a huge increase in our list this last month. We're about to we surpassed 20,000 people on that list. And they're a pretty engaged group of people right now. The open rate for the trumpet brief is way above the industry average for us and in our industry there. So that's been really positive to see. And then I think probably just as positive is the feedback that the writers get from the trumpet brief. In fact, the trumpet brief is our number one place for interaction, our number one source of any feedback now. And I get to see some of that from time to time. And it's just a great way for the writers to interact with the audience.
Yeah, I can attest to that. I've gotten quite a lot of more interaction through email than I ever did before from the readers, people responding directly to the trumpet briefs that we send out. And and it seems like quite a few people that maybe are new to thetrumpet.com find the trumpet brief and enjoy it. And then I'd have to think that someone who sends an email to the author with thanks, or maybe they're pointing out something that we didn't see or criticizing something, but they're engaging with us, that's an unusually motivated individual. That's not something that, like, I guess for every person who would do that, there would be quite a few who maybe read it and enjoyed it, but didn't make the move of actually engaging with us.
Yeah, it's very true. It's definitely a more engaged, potentially more loyal audience. And it's actually a trend industry-wide, as most news organizations outside of, say, New York Times or Wall Street Journal, they don't have the massive audience following, and so they're concentrating on engaging on the most loyal core group of people through, a lot of times, email. And that's also really great for the mobile audience as well. A lot of people check their emails on their phones. So it's all part of the same trend, and it's something that is really advantageous for us. We've tried some experiments on the Trumpet Brief, changing different formats. I don't know if you're not on the Trumpet Brief, you should be on the Trumpet Brief. Last Monday, we had a slight change in the way we formatted the top stories. So what's great about that is you can get some immediate feedback, either through people emailing or just looking at the data from our email sender. And that allows us to really just do what we can to help serve those who are interested.
How does someone get the Trumpet Brief?
So they can get it by going to thetrumpet.com, and they'll see a box that says subscribe here. It'll be towards the top of the homepage. There's also, the box shows up at the top of each article page. And I believe if you're on the desktop, you can reach that sign up on the right sidebar.
Fantastic. We've been talking with our online media manager, David Vigil, giving us the update. We appreciate that, David.
Thanks for having me back.
It's time for today's last word.
The words felt foreign as they slipped from my lips. Sweetie, I just want you to know that I love you. I have no problem with your being emotional right now. I understand why you're upset. Normally, when my wife is upset about something that doesn't seem particularly worth getting upset over, I would react by saying something like, "You shouldn't feel that way. Aren't you overreacting? It seems like you should apologize to that person. Why are you mad at me? I didn't do anything wrong." I instinctively reach for explanations and answers, or even trying to solve the problem as instantaneously as possible. Needless to say, it never works. But amazingly, what I did in this case did work. The distress on my wife's face instantly melted into relief, a smile even. She reached out for a hug. It seemed all the pain had just about vanished in a moment. Dr. Edith Munger says part of our difficulty is that we think we have to have answers for every problem our spouses raise. Actually, a personal relationship is not predicated on solutions to problems or answers to questions. Our top goal should be to understand each other, to get close to each other. When my wife shared her hurt with me, she wasn't looking for solutions. She certainly wasn't inviting my judgment. She was just trying to make a connection. Of course, sometimes when a wife is discouraged or upset, she may need her husband to help her set her thinking straight. Sometimes she does need his problem-solving ability. But virtually all the time, maybe not in every single instance, but almost, even when she needs those other things too, I'm convinced what she needs first, and often solely, is encouragement. There's a beautiful spiritual dimension to this dynamic within a marriage. The marital bond pictures the relationship between Jesus Christ and his people. You can see this described in Ephesians chapter 5. And a husband encouraging his wife points to Jesus Christ doing that for us. 1 John 2 and verse 1 says that when we sin, Jesus Christ becomes our advocate. That word also means encourager. The Trumpet's editor-in-chief, Gerald Fleury, commented on this verse in his book, The Last Hour. He wrote, "How often do you husbands see your wife down and depressed, and you know she needs your encouragement? A righteous husband will be there for his wife." That's what Jesus Christ does for his wife. When his people are discouraged, Christ doesn't make us feel judged or condemned. He's actually doubling his efforts to encourage us and to set us back on our feet. God's love is so multidimensional. God hates sin passionately, and he recognizes our wrong emotions, and he knows that we need to grow up and get rid of them. But at the same time, even in our worst state, his love for us never diminishes. When we're down, especially when it's obviously because of our own sin, wouldn't we be far less inclined to seek God out if all we got from him was cold belittlement or condemnation? But there's tremendous comfort in knowing that when our emotions are out of kilter, we can kneel before God and seek that spiritual connection. We can unburden ourselves. We can talk through our conflicted thoughts, lay bare our weaknesses, and trust that our advocate and encourager will somehow make sense of it all. Romans 8, verse 26 says, "The Spirit helps our infirmities, for we know not what we should pray for as we ought, but the Spirit itself makes intercession for us with groanings which cannot be uttered." There's really no better tool for getting our emotions back into balance. These kinds of prayers help us anchor ourselves to God and His loving, calming, stabilizing presence. We can always draw on His encouragement. And then once we're closer to being right in our thinking, if necessary, God will give us the answers or the correction that we need. Mr. Fleury wrote this, "Our physical marriages are a type of our marriage to Christ. We must strive to pattern our physical marriages after Christ's marriage to the church. Only then are we fulfilling the God-ordained purpose of marriage." Only then, only as we husbands consider his example as a husband and really endeavor to emulate that. Christ's role as our encourager illustrates his love, his concern, his patience, his commitment, and his determination to understand and embrace every individual whom his Father has selected for his bride, probably better than anything else you could name. Emulate him. Be your wife's encourager. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. Send us your comments on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. Thank you very much to my guests today, Callum Wood, Kieran Underwood, Brent Noctegal, and David Vigil. Thanks to our staff as well, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with this thought from Friedrich von Schiller. "The world's history is constant, like the laws of nature, and simple, like the souls of men. The same conditions continually produce the same results." Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.